We bake no bread. This is an evening of philosophical conversation and thanks to some hasty improvisations with some bucket and ice, cold drinks, as there almost wasn't. My name's Grace Lock-Robin and I am the director of Thinking Space, and together with my colleague Liz, we're hosting this evening. Thinking Space is a small non-profit, and we're a group of community philosophers who try and create opportunities like this for people to come together and have philosophical conversations with each other. And some of the work we do is with adult audiences in academic environments like this, but you also will find our work in schools and libraries and hospitals and all kinds of places where people come together to think, and especially in places where people might not have had an experience of doing philosophy before. And I tell you this because it's relevant to the rationale for this evening, for the reason that we've brought you here today. Firstly, it's been made possible because in 2017 we were one of the winners of the Forum for European Philosophy's Thinking in Public grant. And that support, together with the help from the School of Philosophy, Religion and the History of Science here at the University of Leeds, and the generosity of our speakers and also our volunteers, has made it possible for us to invite you here. But the sort of guiding idea for this evening is that the kind of work we do, it's built on a sense that philosophy is valuable, and philosophy in this wider sense is valuable. And so my response to this old saying, philosophy bakes no bread, which was made famous by Bertrand Russell, is that men or women or kids don't live on bread alone, right? So we are sustained by other things as well. And I think philosophy provides a certain kind of sustenance that's really valuable, whether it's meaning or wisdom or conversation with each other. But these kind of claims, so partly, Mary and I were talking, partly these empirical claims, which are hard to evidence, but partly these are philosophical positions about what philosophy is and the right way in which it ought to be evaluated. And we've invited people here tonight to talk a bit about what you think the point of philosophy is. And we want to listen to what you think about the point of philosophy. But to focus our conversations, we've invited three expert philosophers to talk about their work. And so they're going to share something that's currently interesting them. They've only got 10 minutes, so it's going to be brief, but a brief insight into something that they're working on or that is capturing their interest at the moment. But they're sort of bravely putting themselves up for scrutiny, because we're going to consider what the point of the kind of work that they're doing is. And we're going to use that as a springboard to ask these larger questions about the point of philosophy more broadly. So the format for this evening is that we'll hear from each speaker one at a time, Mary first, for 10 minutes. And then we'll talk for 10 minutes about some questions, which we'll share with you presently. And then there'll be 10 minutes to put some of your thoughts, questions, provocations back to the speaker, especially questions that both connect with the substance of what they have been talking about, but also with this wider question of the value or the purpose or the ends of the kind of work that they're engaged in doing. So anyone who's done a little bit of mental maths will have thought there's more time dedicated in this evening then to you guys speaking than to the experts which we've invited here today. And that's on purpose, and I'll speak a bit about why that is later on. But I think that's it really, and all I need to do is introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Mary Leng from the University of York. Mary's been a member of the Department of Philosophy in York since spring 2012, having previously worked at Liverpool and Cambridge. Her research has primarily been in the philosophy of mathematics and science, where she is interested in questions of whether the role played by claims about mathematical objects, such as numbers, in our empirical scientific theories gives us reason to believe in mathematical objects. She's argued that we can view the mathematical assumptions utilised by our empirical scientific theories as useful fictions, so that the use we make of mathematics in scientific theories does not support realism about mathematical objects. Her talk is entitled "The Low Impact of the Philosophy of Mathematics," so please welcome her.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put my timer on here so I don't go over. Okay, so Thanks for having me here. I'm normally very pleased to give public talks on philosophy because it gets me brownie points in my department, because we're encouraged to go out and take philosophy to the world. A, because it's good, but B, because we're told that it's important that philosophy makes an impact on the world, and by telling people about it, that's one way of doing it. This is one occasion where I didn't go and tell our department impact officer what I was doing, because this talk is about how what I do in philosophy of maths actually doesn't have much impact on the world and shouldn't have much impact on the world, but why that's okay. So I thought I was a bit sheepish about going and saying, well, I'm going to undo all we're trying to do on the impact agenda, but here's my attempt to explain why that's all right. So on the question of what the point of philosophy is, I suppose this is a talk more about what the point of philosophy of maths isn't, rather than what the point of philosophy of maths is, and maybe it will be a bit of an exercise for you to work out what it could be for. But as a philosopher of maths, I'm interested in questions of mathematical truth and mathematical knowledge, how maths, as Grace said, gets applied to the world, and trying to understand the nature of mathematics as a practice. And I claim this is a low impact exercise. In philosophy itself, saying something is low impact is meant to be a bad thing, but elsewhere in the world, low impact can be good, right? So a low impact total body workout is a good thing. So I guess I'm trying to make a case for philosophy maybe being a kind of low impact brain workout. It's good for you in a way that maybe doesn't have the kind of impact that you might otherwise expect. But unlike me, the British government, I think, is very much following Marx in his complaint about philosophy, because the British government says all academics must try and have an impact, and so the complaint they have is that philosophy, at least, is that so far philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways, and the point, however, is to change it. So the so-called impact agenda that says all research must have impact on the world, we should all be trying to change the world, is shared, it looks like, by both Marx and the British government, unusually. So anyway, the point ought to be to change the world, says Marx. And this is problematic if you're a philosopher of maths, I think, because if we're philosophers of maths, should we really want to change mathematics? If mathematicians say 2 + 3 = 5, should we say, how about you try this one out? You know, 2 + 3 = 6 might be good. Doesn't seem like it's a good idea to try and change mathematics, really. And certainly a very influential philosopher, David Lewis, has had this to say about the thought that philosophy might try to change what mathematics gets done. He says, I moved to laughter at the thought of how presumptuous it would be to reject mathematics for philosophical reasons. How would you like the job of telling the mathematicians that they must change their ways and abjure countless errors now that philosophy has discovered that there are no classes? Can you tell them with a straight face to follow philosophical argument wherever it may lead? If they challenge your credentials, will you boast of philosophy's other great discoveries, that motion is impossible, that a being than which no greater can be conceived cannot be conceived not to exist, that it's unthinkable that anything exists outside the mind, that time is unreal, that no theory has ever been made at all probable by evidence, but on the other hand, that an empirically ideal theory cannot possibly be false, that it is a wide open scientific question whether anyone has ever believed anything, and so on ad nauseam. Well, not me, says Lewis. And if you think about philosophy and philosophy's track record, there's a track record of disagreement, mathematics and its track record of doing wonderful things that leads to bridges being built and things staying up and so on. You might think, if philosophers are going to come along and say to mathematicians, hold on a minute, you're going to have to change what you're doing, it would be better to ignore the philosophers and let the mathematicians carry on. So that's an argument, at least, or well, perhaps not an argument, but some considerations that would suggest that if philosophy ought to be about changing the world, it's going to be in a difficult situation with regards to mathematics, because mathematics isn't the kind of thing that needs changing. But maybe against that, we might think that kind of those kind of considerations work fine when we're thinking about the kind of mathematics that's well established and accepted. So yes, we're not going to try and change 2 plus 3 equals 5, that works fine. We're not going to try and change the mathematics that we use from day to day. But there have been periods in the development of mathematics, in the history of mathematics, where mathematicians themselves have not been sure about the mathematics that they've been developing, the methods that they're using, and so on. And the example I have here is of Georg Cantor, a mathematician who developed the mathematical theory of the infinite, and opened up this wonderful world in which you no longer think that you can only count 0, 1, 2, 3, dot, 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 and that's it. You can start counting again at the first infinite number and the next infinite number and the next infinite number, and you have a whole infinity of infinities that you can deal with. And this was a wonderful new development in mathematics, but it also led to huge concerns by mathematicians, on behalf of mathematicians, because once you start going beyond the mathematics that we've been used to of counting and dealing with the finite realm, suddenly it opens up the question of, okay, well, if we're now going to do the mathematics of the infinite, what methods can we rely on to do that? We can't really rely on our intuition anymore. What justifies us our developing mathematics in one way rather than another? Cantor's original assumptions about sets turned out to be contradictory, so that was a bit of a problem, and mathematicians had to come up with new axioms for set theory, and there was a question raised there about, well, are these axioms right? Are the kinds of methods right? And so on. And this led in the early 20th century to a big flourishing of philosophy of mathematics, with mathematicians themselves becoming philosophers and interacting with philosophers to try and make sense of this new mathematics. So you might think, well, if it's a controversial bit of mathematics rather than a normal bit of mathematics, maybe philosophy is really important there. It can help us to understand what maths is really about in such a way that we can know whether a particular new method is a good one, whether a choice of axiom is right, and so on and so on. So that looks good. But there's a problem there too. This is Penelope Maddy from UC Irvine, and she points this out about the history of that development. So there were all these methodological worries in mathematics about what to do with these new methods, and she points out that these methodological debates have been settled, so these kinds of definitions are allowed. You don't have to construct entities to assert them to exist. The axiom of choice has been accepted. But the philosophical questions that mathematicians were worrying about remain open, and if that's the case, then it looks like the questions about how to do maths have been settled, but the philosophical debates haven't, and that means that the methodological debates have not been settled on the basis of philosophical considerations. So even in this really good case where you might think, here's a chance for philosophy to make a difference to the mathematics, it looks like mathematicians settled their made their decisions based on reasons that weren't ultimately philosophical. So does that leave any job for the philosophy of mathematics? There's my chocolate teapot suggests maybe not. Well, here's a philosophical question that raises. Why is it that things that philosophers might choose to say about the nature of mathematics and the objects of mathematics and so on turn out to be irrelevant to mathematical practice? Why does mathematics have this autonomy from what philosophers have to say on it? Well, one option would be to say that mathematicians themselves are just the best equipped to determine what counts as truth or knowledge in mathematics, and nothing that philosophers could tell them could be news. And that, if that was the case, it would look like philosophy's job would just be to act as a rubber stamp. Our account of what mathematical objects are should just be whatever mathematicians say. Our account of knowledge must be whatever mathematicians claim to know, and that would be it. That's one option. It might be true, but it's a little bit unsatisfying. I want to suggest another option, that actually the reason why philosophical questions about what mathematical objects are, what we can know, what mathematical truth is, don't make a difference to what mathematics get done, is that mathematicians, when doing maths, aren't really concerned with answering those questions about what objects there are and what we need to what we can know and so on, but are only instead trying to answer questions about what's true according to some mathematical assumptions, or what follows from certain mathematical assumptions that we've made, or what we can know relative to those assumptions. In that case, to the extent that philosophers take a view on what it would have to be for a mathematical claim to account to amount to a genuine item of knowledge, that should make no difference to the internal practice of mathematicians, because mathematicians might not be claiming to know their claims as a body of truth. They might be claiming to just be interested in what would be true were certain axioms to be true. So that's the line I'd prefer, really, which is a philosophical explanation of why philosophical accounts of knowledge don't change what mathematics should be done. And I think it has at least a bit of a distinguished history in the early views of Bertrand Russell, who was mentioned earlier, where he said that mathematics may be defined as a subject which we never know what we're talking about, nor whether what we're saying is true. And I'm there. Thank you.
So I would like to hear from a handful of from the facilitators, really, if they can, would they would like to put forward any comments they heard that might be useful to get us started, and kind of suggest that we maybe think about, in the first instance, there may be a few comments that engage with the substance of understanding Mary's argument, and then perhaps some follow-up comments might deal more with getting to grips with the point of the philosophy of maths. So I don't know if anyone has any of those more kind of comprehension-y or those kind of questions about the substance of her argument to start. Anything not suitable? Do you want to start?
We had a really interesting range of different points of view in our group, really closely connected to the substance of your argument and this relationship between maths and philosophy. I wonder, would one of you mind offering the point of view that you related to me rather than me trying to summarise it for you? Would you mind?
Yeah. Thank you very much. So I was particularly interested with the last question, and I thought I basically agreed entirely with what you said, not so much as trying to prove maths wrong, going there as a philosopher. It's more going into an area that we're not experts on and asking slightly different questions that a philosopher would, and I thought that's pretty much kind of what philosophy is. It's going into a subject area without the knowledge of an expert and asking different questions that can get not different answers but maybe deeper answers, and getting more to the, again, not root, but arriving at slightly different forms of knowledge, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So rather than saying 2 + 3 isn't 5, because I'm a philosopher, maybe saying, I mean, asking a question, maybe why is two, but or just another way of thinking that can maybe just help the mathematician, yeah, in their field.
Thanks. Am I meant to respond? Or
yeah, please. We'd love to.
Okay, great.
Think,
yeah. That's really helpful. So, I guess as a philosopher of maths, I see maths as a practice that's out there of interest to look at and see what's going on. And so the questions I'm naturally going to ask about maths are very different from the questions mathematicians ask when doing maths. They want to know, can I prove this theorem, right? And I want to know, well, what, when mathematicians go about proving theorems, what are they establishing? Are they establishing that something is true with a kind of certainty, or are they establishing what follows from their assumptions? Are the assumptions ever challenged by the mathematicians and so on? And it's not that mathematicians couldn't ask those questions, but if they were asking those questions, they wouldn't be doing them as mathematicians, they'd be doing them as philosophers. And many mathematicians do think about those sort of meta questions. And it's not, I guess, that the philosopher... So you talked about the philosopher being inexpert, and I guess it's a bit unfair on some, probably not me, but on some philosophers of maths. Some philosophers of maths are very expert in maths itself, but they've chosen to consider the philosophical questions because what interests them is not the first order practice, but understanding the nature of that practice. So it is just two different levels of questions, and so in trying to say there's a point to the second level, to the philosophical bit, Not everything has to be about changing a practice when you're trying to understand it. So when anthropologists go and look at a new tribe or something, they don't want to change what they're doing, they just want to understand. And that sometimes can be enough, actually. So we're naturally interested in our practices and trying to make sense of them. That doesn't always mean trying to make them better or improve on them, because sometimes they can't be improved.
Does anyone else have a question or comment that connected either in agreement or disagreement with particularly that last issue about how exactly we're supposed to assess the impact of mathematics and whether change is the aim of the game? Is there anything useful that you think happened on your table that you want to put forward, Nazia? Connected to that or somewhere else?
Yes, connected, although tangentially possibly. I feel we had quite polarising views on our table. Farida had, I'm going to pass the mic to you in a minute, to talk about the possible worlds theory, to provide a space for which to talk about mathematics in this way. Because I think having that space is really important to go, okay, let's abandon the notions of what we were taught to believe. The other thing I think that we ended up in quite an interesting place was something David started to say, which is, I know 2 + 3 = 5, but does that really matter when actually, if the first number plus the second number equals more than, then isn't this just a moot point? And we started to think about it in terms of substituting those numbers for language like a lesser number plus another number equals more than. So isn't that what's true here? Mm-hmm. But if you just
want to
talk about possible worlds.
It just relates to a module that I'm currently studying, and it was the idea that we were discussing whether numbers would exist in the same way in another possible world, and if they would exist, or if whether they're like reliant on us and our understanding of them, such that they, in another possible world, numbers wouldn't exist because us as humans wouldn't be there to understand them, and sort of we give the way we understand numbers, it's like us I don't know if that makes, as in like numbers are reliant on our understanding of it, like we I don't know, I'm not explaining it very well. But
I know what you mean. So one way of putting that, they're just sticking in our world, I guess, is, you know, if even and this is sometimes presented as a Platonist point, a point in favour of mathematical objects and mathematical truth, is a thought, well, look, mathematical objects can't be dependent on us, because even before there were ever any humans, 2 dinosaurs + 3 dinosaurs made 5 dinosaurs, right? And that means that mathematical truth must transcend in some way our concepts or our ability to conceptualize it. It's something objective about the world that 2 dinosaurs + 3 dinosaurs makes 5 dinosaurs. So that's a picture that says, well, look, what mathematics is not dependent, at least on human concepts and humans thinking about these things. I guess your possible world's spin on it might change that a bit, because you might think, well, look, if the world was very different, would 2 dinosaurs + 3 dinosaurs, but still had dinosaurs in somehow, would 2 dinosaurs + 3 dinosaurs make 5 dinosaurs? So can you imagine a very strange world where whenever, a world that doesn't like multitudes, so whenever you have 2 things popping into existence and then 3 more things popping into existence, the world doesn't like 5, so suddenly some of them disappear. If that was what the world would be like, then maybe 2 dinosaurs + 3 dinosaurs makes 5 dinosaurs wouldn't be something that would be true of that world. But this kind of gets back to your question, really, of what the meaning of these these arithmetic claims really is. If we think of arithmetic truths as claims about collections of objects in our world, then there's a possibility of it, had the world been very different, they would have been very different. And one way of getting around that is to say, well, the truths of arithmetic, the truths that mathematicians are concerned with, are only kind of happenstance related to those generalizations. So it's interesting to us that 2 plus 3 equals 5 because of its relation to general claims like 2 things plus 3 things makes 5 things, which apply very nicely in our world but might be very different in worlds where things didn't stick around for a long time. But from a mathematical perspective, what 2 plus 3 equals 5 is a claim about the abstract objects 2 and 3 and 5 and their relations to each other, and that they're going to be how they are no matter what the world's like. So if that was the picture that you had, then the world could be completely different, but the mathematical truths would still be the same.
Thank you very much. We're out of time for contributions, so I'm really sorry, Erin. But thank you very much, Mary. Mm-hmm. Please can you give Mary a round of applause? I hope that has given people a bit of an insight into the kind of work she does, and also an interesting spin on the low impact of the philosophy of mathematics. Our next speaker is Professor Erin Meskin. Let me just find out what I know about you. Professor Erin Meskin is the Professor of Philosophy, Director of the Centre for Aesthetics, and the Programme Director for Philosophy, Psychology and Scientific Thought Programme here at the University of Leeds. He's edited 5 books and is the author of numerous journal articles and book chapters on philosophical aesthetics, the philosophy of food, and other philosophical subjects. He's spoken at a variety of public venues, including the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art, the Henry Moore Institute, the Thought Bubble Comics Festival, Pro Dance Leeds and Beacon's Music Festival, and Deershed Festival as well. And he's going to speak to us about foodies, gluttony, and why philosophers are so concerned with eating. So please welcome him.
So say from the sublime to the tasty, or that from pie to pie?
That's
Also, another joke. I do make bread. Right, so just I want you to think about whether that sort of is a counterexample, and also to the claim. And also, I do say to my students, honestly, when we have the paper writing session, that they should think of writing a paper like baking a loaf of bread. I could tell you about that, but I'll tell you about that later. But no, really, I do. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this thing that I've been thinking about. I've also been thinking a lot about hip-hop, but I'm going to talk today about foodies and gluttony. There we go. So I think we find philosophy all around us, philosophical ideas, arguments, comments, debate, all over the place with our friends, with our enemies, in the newspapers, all the time. Doing philosophy, that is thinking, not just blurting out whatever we think, but actually thinking systematically about these philosophical matters, what the right thing to do is with respect to eating meat, for example, can help us sort out what we should think and what we should do. So I'll take an example, a bizarre example, but it's close to the heart for some reasons that you might be able to figure out. The popular debate about foodies, the popular debate. What are they? Is there something wrong with them? Is there something wrong with us, foodies? So here are the questions. What is a foodie? Classic kind of philosophical. What is justice? What is truth? What is beauty? What is foodie? And is there something wrong with being a foodie? So that's the Urban Dictionary top definition, a douchebag who likes food. Okay, so those are my questions, philosophical questions. Okay, so it turns out I'm not the only philosopher who's thought about food. I thought I was the only philosopher who thought about this, but Susan Wolf, very well-known, important ethicist, has a paper that just came out called The Ethical Dimension of Foodies, or Ethics of Foodies. So she actually gives a definition, a philosophical definition of the foodie, which, of course, I think is wrong. That's what philosophers do. Here she is, an enthusiast about food for aesthetic reasons, someone who loves food, or more precisely, who loves tasting food, and has interest in it, to be willing to spend a considerable portion of his or her expendable income and time exploring, studying, and sampling food. Okay, so it's nice, something to work with there. any, we can think about whether counterexamples, if you've got problems with it. I mean, I should say one thing, it seems to me, is no problem being a cheap foodie. So I don't think willingness to spend a considerable portion should be a necessary condition. But that's just a minor thing. There's a lot more to say about that. So I'm not, like, I find these questions like, what is a foodie, very interesting. I don't think like we're, I think it's a bit of a mug's game to try to come up with necessary and sufficient conditions to give a definition of these things. I like often thinking about the kind of typical features of a foodie. We'll talk about the founding foodies in a second. So here are some typical features. I come to this from thinking about art, where a really good way of thinking about art kinds and genres is to start, rather than trying to define the art kind, but to think about the typical features of the art kind. So I think a typical foodie is willing to spend a significant amount on food. I don't think it's necessary. Significant interest in the history, preparation, and production of food. Significant interest in talking about food, blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you about the restaurant that I like. Interests that range beyond hot cuisine. Foodies aren't the gourmets. They're like interested in like where to get the best kebab also. They self-identify as having a food-related hobby. They're interested in food-related socializing, very typical of foodies. And finally, and this is why the founding foodies comes up, I kind of think that it's a standard feature of the foodie that they belong to a culture with the foodie concept. That's why I think founding foodies is so bizarre. They didn't have the concept of the foodie. And it is really strange to think about people in the 18th century as being foodies. What I actually think is we don't really get foodies until the term gets coined in the early 80s. So my hypothesis is that the foodie is a historically and culturally specific social role. It's a social role that comes into being at a certain time. People invent a term and some features associated with it, and people sort of start acting in accordance with that. The world changes so that there become a lot more availabilities to be a foodie. Look at what's happened in Leeds in the last couple of years. So much easier to be a foodie in this town. I think if we look at social constructionist theories of race and gender, there's a lot of work on how these culturally and historically specific categories come into being. We can get a handle on the development of this category, but I just had this idea like 3 days ago, so we'll have to do a lot more philosophy to determine whether it's right. Okay, so now let's get on to the criticism. So, foodies, douchebags who like food, whatever. Okay, so a bunch of public intellectuals have said the following. Foodies are just gluttons. They're just modern-day gluttons, gluttons in disguise. Myers in America, Stephen Poole in The Guardian, all modern-day foodists. He doesn't like foodie, he likes foodist. Kind of to link to nudist. Are certainly gluttons. So the idea is not just one particular thing. It's not just that foodies are gluttons. It's the idea that foodies are gluttons because they're foodies. That's right. It might be that everyone's a glutton. That wouldn't be this claim. This claim is that foodies are gluttons in virtue of their foodiness. If they're right, I better reconsider my life. Because gluttony is bad. Okay. Although, good. Here's a misunderstanding of the claim. So this is from a former student of mine who wrote a piece on gluttony. He argued that gluttony describes the action of overindulging in food or drink, or a state of character in which one regularly overindulges in food and drink. Now, I'll admit some foodies do every now and then overindulge. I'll admit that. But I think it would be a mistake to say, if that's right, then the charge from gluttony is misguided, because it would be a mistake to say that foodies in general overindulge. Lots of foodies don't overindulge. they go blabber out about their food and spend a lot of money and make their bread and stuff like that, but they don't necessarily overindulge. But that's a misunderstanding of the criticism, and you have to do a little bit of philosophy, like a little history, yo, to get straight on this. So gluttony was never, well, at least among the medieval philosophers and the Greek philosophers, was not about simply overeating or overconsumption. Gluttony was an inordinate desire, caring too much about food, making us depart from reason, an inordinate preoccupation from food. You can be inordinately preoccupied with food without eating too much. You could maybe eat too little or too daintily, like you're obsessed with dainty food. So I think that's the right way to understand gluttony. That's the general, that's just a kind of a, just a gestures at the view, but the idea is that the gluttonous person cares too much for the pleasures of food. And they needn't overeat, they care too much. They're obsessed about it. They talk about it all the time. Right? So now you can understand by thinking a little bit about how the medieval thinkers and Greek thinkers thought about gluttony, we can understand what the charge from gluttony really is. So, hypothesis. The hypothesis is that foodies are gluttons because they care too much about the pleasures of food. They like there's like they could, I don't know, they could write their papers, they could do their research, they could take care of their children. But no, instead they have to go to the cheese shop. Okay, a little autobiography, whatever. But this caring might not be manifested in overeating. So is this right? So that's the question. How do we figure if they care too much? A little history. It's so sad. A little history, Aquinas. There are like at least, this is Elizabeth Telfer who wrote about this, definitely rooted in Aquinas' thinking. There are, in fact, three reasonable, uncontroversial standards for what counts as a glutton: damage to one's health, failure to respect one's obligations to others, like, I don't take care of my child because all I do is go to the cheese shop. Right? That's a possibility. I eat too much cheese and my liver engorges, or whatever. I guess it's not really liver, but... Or the inability to carry out plans. I've got a book to write on research leave, but I keep on ending up at the cheese shop. Okay, that's the idea. Now, if you think about it, okay, you can see that some foodies are like that, but foodies in general, there's no reason to think that in general they meet these criteria, right? Their plans might be to get food, get tasty food. Many foodies are perfectly healthy. They're a vegan. There are plenty of vegan and vegetarian foodies out there. Plenty of healthy and moral foodies who respect their obligations to others. You might say, what about obligations to animals? I think that's a complicated case, but remember, the issue is about whether foodies are gluttons in virtue of their foodiness, right? They might be failing to respect their obligations to animals, but almost everyone else is too, or all the meat eaters are too. So there's no special problem with foodies there. My contention is that the foodie does care a great deal about the pleasure of the food, but they're not making a mistake. They're not caring too much. They're caring to the right degree. They care about the pleasures, the right sorts of pleasures, and care about them to the right amount, as opposed to non-foodies who don't care enough about the pleasures of food. But to make that sort of case, I'll have to do some more philosophy. That's what I got for you. Want to hear the bread thing?
Yes.
So my line about papers, that like most papers have too much stuff in them, like, and bread, basically you need like, you know, water, salt, yeast, flour. I mean, okay, you could be a sourdough person, whatever. But like, I like stick with the four ingredients, don't throw in the cranberries.
Can we come back together and share some of these thoughts with Erin? Is the who led this discussion? Did you? Okay. Is there someone's comment you'd like to put forward? So yeah, we're coming back together, guys. And second, Nazir, I'll ask if there's anyone's thoughts you want to put forward. But Liz is going to start.
There are a couple of issues on our table. One to do with this idea of identifying as a foodie, and another to the claim was made that a sincere engagement with food and food culture, a sincere person who does that wouldn't take the name foodie, wouldn't identify as foodie.
As a matter of fact, I think some do and some don't. My experience, like, I'm perfectly fine with the term, but some of my friends... So I'm pretty into food. That's like one of the main things I think about. I'm perfectly fine with the term. I guess I kind of self-identify that way. One of my friends, like, he hates the term. We constantly argue about it on Facebook. The third guy that the two of us always talk about food, he sort of can go either way. I think people are just split on it. Some people do. I just had a discussion with a friend of mine who wrote about like social construction and social roles, and I was like, what do you think about foodies and hipsters? And he said, foodies, that's a perfectly good social role because people identify that, but no one identifies as a hipster. They don't exist. That's what he said to me, which I think is also false. But it's a good question. I mean, interesting question. I don't know what the answer is about the numbers of people, but I think plenty of people do identify as foodies.
That's it?
In classical Rome, then, well, what's about the foodies then?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the thing that I think is that's the thing that got me thinking about this whole sort of social role, social construction thing. I mean, obviously people have been concerned about food and really interested in the pleasures of food and eating for centuries and millennia. You're absolutely right. But it's weird. I think it's really weird to think about them as foodies. That's why I put up the founding foodies. Like, yo, George Washington was not a foodie. I mean, the term foodie gets invented is used first in 1981. And it seems like, so the term gets invented. Now, the fact that the term is invented doesn't show that it doesn't follow that those things didn't exist before, because like the word gene or the word DNA didn't exist for the Greeks, but they presumably had DNA. But I do feel like in this case, like something sort of, at least this is my hypothesis, that with the invention of this word and then people's theories about what a foodie was, that kind of changed the social world so that it became as a kind of a role that people could play. And that's why we have like this, there's so many foodies now. Like there are so many fucking hipsters. So,
are they completely different people?
No. But people can play lots of, people can play multiple social roles. So I've got this idea that like foodie, kind of from thinking about the weirdness of applying foodie to the Romans or foodie to the founding fathers, to Alexander Hamilton, made me think that it's this like social role that appears like towards the end of last century, and then, yeah. So I think it's a good question, and I think it's a serious question. I said I had to make a philosophical argument. What it feels very strange to me to talk about foodies in the distant past. And that makes me feel like it's a kind of emerging social role. That's why I appeal to things like, mentioned like certain like kind of race categories where a lot of people think these racial categories appear at a particular time. Even though obviously people had different skin colors and different phenotypic features for millennia, the racial categories appear at a particular time. That's the kind of analogy I'm drawing. But I'm kind of just gesturing at that. It's like the beginning of my thinking about it.
Erin, when you set up your problem, sorry, I'm behind you, just lurking behind you. When you set up your problem, you sort of jote. So what is justice? What is truth? What is a foodie? And we spent 10 minutes or something on this question, what is a foodie? And I just wondered whether any of the tables have done any consideration of whether this is a legitimate question for philosophers to be spending their time in, whether Erin, as a philosopher of food, is too concerned with the philosophy of food. Was that a yes, one on your table?
I have a question along those lines, and then I'm going to pass the mic to Stuart, who wants to ask, are we talking about philosophy or psychology here? But my question is, what does the word foodie do that the word gourmand doesn't do?
Oh, actually, a gourmand is just a trencherman. A gourmand, actually, the definition of gourmand is someone who likes to eat a lot. So you might be thinking of gourmet, which is different than gourmand. A gourmet, typically, when I make the distinction that's typically made, is that a gourmet is interested in, particularly in high, sophisticated food. But foodies, like me, Yo, are not just interested. I mean, I like sophisticated food, don't get me wrong. But I'm also very interested in, like, you know, chips and where to get the best chips and gravy, or where to get a good kebab. Or like where to get the best fish and chips. So there's at least that kind of distinction between the gourmet and the foodie. The gourmet tends to go, think about it like a kind of high art and low art distinction. People make that. The gourmet tends to look, be interested in the Michelin star food. Because the foodie is often interested in like street food.
Right, you seem to have opened up a really good, I don't want to say can of worms, because that's a pretty bad pun, but no, it's really interesting. What interested me about it is actually the lap over between the philosophical aspect of this and the psychological aspect of it. I'll put my cards on the table by saying that of all the things that are on offer in the Leeds University refectory every day, my favourite food is actually beans and chips. I don't eat it every day, but when I do eat it, wow. So what interests me actually is the lap over between the fields of philosophy and psychology here. Because I would actually regard the whole business of being a foodie, be it newspaper articles, television programs, people themselves, as actually appealing to people's nature of being a child. Yeah, where they like to find things they can kind of boast about in really subtle ways. And be one up on people. Yep. In philosophical terms, I guess it fits in with some of the thoughts of Nietzsche. You know, the man and Superman model, we can interpret it in various ways. We've done for 100 years and we still haven't settled on an argument. But that would seem to be my knowledge of philosophy. It's the one classical philosopher who actually is probably in tune with what's going on at the moment. So the notion of a foodie as essentially a boastful child, I think fits into this into the philosophical argument really, really well. It's something that should be extended.
Okay, Erin, you've got 1 minute to respond to that, you boastful child.
Just finally on that thought, if anybody's
interested about the lamb roast I made the other day. It was off the hook.
If anybody's interested in how people may or may not have behaved in historical times as being foodies, I'd recommend the Alexander Korda film called The Private Life of Henry VIII, where he shows Henry VIII eating a chicken. Thus.
Okay, so, I'm super interested in the intersections between philosophy and psychology. I have a collaborator in psychology and I do experimental work with her that's linked to some philosophical project. That goes back, that connection between philosophy and psychology goes way back in history. Certainly the 18th century dudes up in Scotland all thought about a very close connection between a science of human nature, the psychology of human nature, and a philosophical moral project. And I see what I do as continuous with that. Boastful child. I mean, it's a bold claim. It's the sort of claim that I think deserves philosophical scrutiny.
Can we thank Erin, please, for a show? Thank you very much. Really interesting. Okay, so we've got our final speaker now. I would really like to introduce you to Jo Saunders, who's also from the University of Leeds. Jo works at Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied here at Leeds, where he teaches applied ethics in a variety of disciplines. His research primarily focuses on ethics and agency in Kant and in the post-Kantian tradition. He's currently co-translating a new book, a new edition of Kant's groundwork for the metaphysics of morals. He's also co-writing a book on well-being and economics. His other interests include metaethics and the philosophy of love. And Joe's talk is called Selves and Systems, the Value of the History of Philosophy. So please welcome him. Thank you.
I just found myself clapping there, which is a really embarrassing start to things. So as you just heard, I work on the history of philosophy primarily. And here's a fair question to ask me. What on earth is the point of that, right? Why study Immanuel Kant? What type of bizarre... I must have been 20-something when I became fixated by Immanuel Kant. What type of bizarre 20-year-old becomes fixated by a dead German man and decides that's what he's going to spend his life doing? Okay, so I'm going to try and answer that a bit today. I should say that my talk's maybe a bit more... It's like I'm towing the party line on these things, so I think both Mary and Aaron have given quite sophisticated and nuanced takes on what they're dealing with. But I'm not. I'm just going to full-on argue that the history of philosophy is really important. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, so what is the history of philosophy? Well, as the name suggests, there are kind of two main parts to it. So the first part is history, and the second part's philosophy. So I'll say something about both in turn. So the history stuff... With the history of philosophy, what we're doing is we're looking at the history of past thoughts. We're looking at the origin of our ideas and the development of our ideas and concepts over time. And that's helpful because it will allow us to understand where they come from. And here, we're all kind of familiar with the phrase that, you know, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Right? It's a familiar thought. And you can imagine someone who's over-enthusiastic about the history of philosophy saying that about the history of philosophy, saying something like, you know, those who do not remember the history of philosophy are condemned to repeat philosophy. Or those who do not remember past thoughts are condemned to repeat past thoughts. You could imagine someone saying that. That seems too strong to me, right? Some past thoughts are best left in the past. So for instance, we might not remember the ins and outs of alchemy, but that doesn't mean we're like condemned to spend our days trying to turn things into gold, right? We're kind of just given up on it. Or we might not remember the theory of the four humours, but that doesn't mean we're condemned to spend our days with ineffectual medical practices, just botching every attempt to heal a human being. Okay, so the thought that, you know, if we don't remember past thoughts, we're condemned to repeat them seems a little bit strong. But there is something to it, and I think especially there's something to it in the case of philosophy. And why? Well, because the history of philosophy is not just history. Sure, it helps you understand where your ideas come from, the origin and development of ideas. But in doing the history of philosophy, my claim is that you also end up doing philosophy, right? So I think it's a case where in doing a discipline that's about a discipline, you end up doing that discipline itself. In the same way, so Mary was arguing in a way that when you do the philosophy of mathematics, it's kind of insulated from the results of mathematics itself. I'm going to suggest that philosophy doesn't quite work in that way. Its relationship with the history of philosophy is one such that when you do the history of philosophy, you just end up doing philosophy. Okay, so why on earth is that? Well, it just helps to think a little bit about what it involves to do the history of philosophy. So let's take one big movement. You have Plato, and then you have Aristotle, right? People are familiar with these two Greek guys. If I had slides, I'd have the School of Athens with, you know, Plato pointing up. Aristotle saying, well, I can't do it, but I can act it out for you now, right? Plato's pointing up. Aristotle saying, woe damn. And if you want to do some history of philosophy, one of the big transitions would be the move from Plato to Aristotle. But in order to understand that, you have to understand what Plato was doing, right? You have to understand his motivation, the problems he was dealing with, the arguments he offers, his ideas, his reasons, his systems, his concept, what he's working with. In understanding why Aristotle comes about and departs from him, you have to understand Aristotle's dissatisfaction with Plato. Why did Aristotle think Plato didn't work? What were the problems he saw in Plato's system? And what motivated him to move towards something else? And in doing this, you're engaging with Plato's ideas, his arguments, his systems, his motivations, and you're engaging with Aristotle's critiques. And that's just to do philosophy, right? You're playing around with concepts, reasons, ideas, arguments, and that type of thing. So at its most basic, that's the thought that the history of philosophy is both history, but it's also philosophy. Pretty straightforward. Another thing that I'd like to point out, and this is kind of a dual-edged sword. So one of the bad things about the history of philosophy is it typically focuses on dead white men, right? So there's a group of people who've been historically overrepresented and have oppressed people historically. There have been other groups of people who've been historically underrepresented and oppressed. That's a bad-making feature of the history of philosophy, which is just always worth flagging up. But there is something to be said for studying these great figures of the past. I think we should always be aware of the problems with it. But what is there to be said for it? Well, one, you know, helping you understand the origin of the ideas. The other thought is that they offer systems of thinking. So when I ask myself for this, what do I like about the history of philosophy? Why am I drawn to the history of philosophy rather than any particular area of philosophy? It's that I think it deals with things at perhaps a broader level. Right? So if you approach someone like Kant, it's not just that Kant has one argument or one view on something. There's an entire system of thought, right? Kant has a metaphysical picture. He has a metaphysical picture. He has a conception of human nature. He has an ethics, an aesthetics, a theory of value, and they're all intimately related, right? They're not contingently there. They all kind of interconnect. And it's entirely different, that system of thought, from Hume's, which is also entirely different from Aristotle's. And one thing I really like is engaging with different systems of thoughts at that level and thinking, how on earth do you adjudicate between two different systems of thought? I can tell if Aaron offers me a definition of a foodie and someone else offers me a definition of foodie, I can kind of figure out which one I think is better, right? Think through typical cases, counterexamples. But how on earth do you engage with entire systems of thought? I find that kind of challenging and exciting. Okay, so that's the abstract stuff I'm going to do. History of philosophy is history and philosophy. I like it because I like engaging in big picture, woolly thinking about systems. Then I thought I'd give you three brief examples of maybe why this is worthwhile. Thankfully, Aaron already gave us one in that if you want to think about gluttony, it might be useful to think about the history of gluttony. Okay, first example is really simple. And this is, again, I was worried you were going to be skeptical, so I was going to come hard at you with the value of the history of philosophy. So I currently run a MA program for medical students and doctors where they come and study medical ethics. Okay. They're often doctors with long careers, or they're medical students. They're going to, you know, encounter a whole month of ethical issues, so they come and study for a year and learn about medical ethics. And we begin the MA with a course in the history of philosophy. So they show up, here they are, they've got their year off work, or they're coming out of their medical degree, and the first lecture is just wham, Plato. And they've got to go and read Plato and listen to me talk about Plato for hours. Then they get 2 weeks of Aristotle. Bam. And then they get me on Kant. They get someone else on Hume. They get someone else on utilitarianism. And they hate it. Right? Of course, Ed. Aristotle's difficult. It's impossible. Kant's a nightmare to read. And we don't give them easy bits, right? We give them hard aspects of this philosophy. So typically, they hate the course as they're doing it. And they don't just hate it. They think, why on earth are we doing this? And their kind of urge is, look, we're doctors. We want to engage with real issues. Like the ethics of euthanasia. I want to know, I'm worried about physician-assisted suicide. I'm worried about abortion and when that's permissible and when it's not. I'm worried about the use of drugs, things like that. Then the rest of the modules of the MA, we go on to cover those things. And what we typically find is that the students end up having found the introduction to the history of philosophy incredibly helpful. Because when they deal with particular issues, they just have different systems of thoughts they can draw on. They'll be like, oh, look, that's vaguely Kantian in the way it approaches it. Oh, I can understand there's something Aristotelian going on. And at the end, and maybe this is just them telling it to me because I say, hey, wasn't that great? They say, sure. At the end of the whole program, they seem to say that they really wish they could go and do the first module again right now because it would be useful. So that was my attempt to convince the hardline skeptics of you that what I do has some worse. Okay. Second example, which will be very brief, I just want to flag it up because it's something I'm working on at the minute and I find interesting, is our good old friend love. Right? Valentine's Day yesterday, love seems like an important feature of human life. If you want to know how the heart, not metaphorically, how the actual heart works, don't go read an ancient Greek text on the heart, right? Just go ask someone who currently knows about how the heart works. But if you want to know something about the nature of love, one of the best places to go would be back to Plato's Symposium. It's still an incredibly rich and rewarding text. Don't believe me? Go read it, right? Go read Plato's Symposium and tell me you don't find that an interesting work on love. So again, the thought there is that the history of philosophy, if you want to think about love, is a really important place to go. Okay, final example is thoughts about well-being. And again, here I kind of want to suggest that the history of philosophy plays a different role than the philosophy of mathematics does with regard to mathematics. So Aaron before mentioned that he was kind of like on board with a bunch of 18th century dead Scottish dudes, right, who were kind of interested in human psychology. Think here like people like Adam Smith and David Hume. So Adam Smith and David Hume, both philosophers, and they both had a particular conception of the human being, right? The human being had some desires, preferences, natural sympathies, and then it just went about pursuing those. Reason played little to no role, right? You just have some desires, preferences, you go about trying to satisfy them. And what a good human life ends up being is just one in which your desires and preferences are satisfied, right? That's crude, but that's roughly the kind of picture of human nature we get coming out of that tradition. Now, if you know anything about Adam Smith, you'll know that he's kind of the founding father of economics. So this idea has been really prevalent in economic theory. So the classical economists operate with that conception of the human being, but also the neoclassical economists in the 20th century operate with something like this conception of the human being. Neoclassical economics conceives as the human being as someone with just a bunch of desires and preferences, who then goes about maximally trying to satisfy those, right? I like the green beer, not the other beer, and I just go about trying to get the green beer to whatever degree I want. And they say that's what a good life is. A good life is one in which our desires are just optimally satisfied. Now, it turns out that if you think life's just about satisfying desires, the market, at least in theory, is a really good mechanism for that, right? You come to the market, you have some preferences, you have some money, hey, presto, you get the things you want. So here's a view of the human being that was formed in a particular period of history that's been incredibly influential, both in philosophy, but also remains influential in certain strands of economics. So that's what was going on. Neoclassical economics was kind of the paradigm of economics in the middle of the 20th century. And then something happened. Aristotle came back, right? There was a revival of thought on Aristotle, led by thinkers like Elizabeth Anscombe and later Philippa Foot, people like Martha Nussbaum, suddenly got really excited in Aristotle and got more interested in Aristotle's conception of what the human being is. And for Aristotle, the human being is not just a desiring creature that happens to have preferences. The human being is a rational creature and a social creature. And the key point for Aristotle is that our desires and preferences can be changed through reason and habituation. So Aristotle's not particularly interested in us just going and satisfying our desires, right? In general, the Greeks aren't. They think that's just like a bird flying around, eating berries, pooping. There's nothing really rewarding about that. What's rewarding is about cultivating your desires and, you know, having the right habits and also flourishing as a human being. So there is a movement where an ancient philosopher comes back into prominence in thinking about philosophy and well-being. And that ended up having huge ramifications in economics. So people like Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum have done really important work on economics where they try and reconfigure the whole discipline. Say, let's stop thinking about just satisfying people's preferences. People have all sorts of terrible or uninteresting or destructive preferences. Let's think about increasing capabilities or making people's lives go well more broadly. And so then this is a slightly provocative thought of mine. In doing so, I mean, these are people who are not white, right? They're not all white, they're not dead, and they're not just male. And they're doing work that hopefully helps people all around the globe, but they're kind of appealing to this old white dead dude, Aristotle. So I think, you know, you might be able to say something to salvage that then. Okay, so that's it for me. History of philosophy, history and philosophy, some examples. Thanks.
Any comments or questions for Joe? Yeah. Oh.
This is maybe just comments that we talked about that you maybe want to jump in on. So we started off talking about the kind of second question a little bit more, and I think we sort of broadly concluded that actually it is important to learn about these characters and their ideas, because they have been quite formative, but actually, as you said, sort of putting them in context. And then we had quite an interesting discussion. Just we were thinking right at the end about whether it's important to retain a distinction between history and history of philosophy and doing philosophy, and how actually maybe when it comes perhaps to primary school kids, it's important to sort of have that distinction, particularly if you're talking about philosophical thoughts that are best forgotten. Actually, sometimes there's a place for learning about them, but actually not necessarily engaging in them. And actually, there's kind of other times where actually it will be more helpful to be doing the philosophy itself. So that was kind of how our discussion meandered.
Cool, yeah. So really interesting thought. So one thing to say is I sent this, so I wrote some thoughts about this and sent it to a friend who's a prominent historian and philosopher. And he's like, I know you didn't intend this, but it kind of sounds like you're defending dead white men. And I was like, okay, that wasn't intentional. I just kind of wanted to flag it up and then say something about it. So I should note that one of the great strides forward in the history of philosophy at the minute is there's been tons of work done on the early modern period. And the early modern period is a period of philosophy in which there are tons of female writers and interesting philosophers. So the canon is expanding and other people's thoughts are coming into it. There's also interesting work that's been done on even... So part of us is just guilt, right? Like as a 20-something-year-old, I got really into Kant, spent way too much time on Kant. Then I'm like, oh, God, all I do is go on about some dead white guy. Like, am I doing something horrible here? So there's been really interesting work done on some of the people Kant had correspondence with. So there's a philosopher at Cambridge, Ray Langton, who's got a series of papers on a correspondence Kant had with a young woman called Maria Herbert, who basically read all of his books and was like, Kant, this is brilliant. But there was a romance that went wrong in her life, and she got in touch and tried to ask him for advice, and he was absolutely fucking useless, like hopeless. And she's like, and he would try to say something. She's like, no, I've read all your books. I get your whole thing. It just doesn't help. What can I do in this case? And it's really depressing how ineffectual and hopeless he is with her. And you can see she really understands it and wants to engage with him, but just lived in a time where she wouldn't have had the opportunities to pursue that. And it's quite a tragic case. I think she ends up killing herself in response to it. But there's a series of papers about this. So it's really interesting in thinking of the ways in which people who aren't dead white men figure in and around the philosophical canon. So the second thought was about kids and school, right? So I was saying, like, I work on Kant, so a lot of my friends are German, and then I go to conferences in Germany and chat to them. And one thing you hear there is that they all studied philosophy in high school, right? That's part of the curriculum. They all studied philosophy, and they all hated it. They all absolutely despised it because it kind of came this thing where, oh, you go to an exam, and what did Kant say? Well, Kant said there was a categorical imperative. What did Plato say? There was a theory of a form. So they're not really, you feel like, you get the impression they weren't really doing with philosophy and engaging with problems or thinking. They were just kind of repeating what a bunch of dead people said, and it really put them off. So I think that's something to be really careful about. Was there a third thought in there that I've completely forgotten?
So we just touched upon that first question, and I think we were all pretty much in consensus that actually it's not dangerous in itself to discuss the ideas that people put forward, and actually it's probably more helpful to discuss them and think about why they were wrong or why actually it's important to sort of remember them but not take them forward than it is to just forget them completely. Actually, that would potentially be more dangerous to not have that discussion. So that was kind of our ideas about the first.
Sounds good to me. All very sympathetic to the stupid thing that I spend my time doing. So I'm Simon.
Liz's group, is there anyone who wants to say anything?
We were talking about, this gentleman talked about how the history of philosophy is very highly subjective on interpretation and what knowledge is passed through and documented. And we drew on also the fact that philosophers are, or were, generally outcast in society. Would you deem it important to highlight that fact, or do you think that purely their system of thought is important and their social status is not? And do you think that it's something that we should leave out, or do you think it's important to teach that as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess there are political ramifications of it, right? So if you think of philosophers as critics or conscience of society, then there's a nice way in which they have outsider status. So one of the big things that some people bemoan about philosophy is that maybe it changed when it got institutionalized. So I think I'm right in saying that Kant was the first philosophy professor. It didn't really exist in that way before Kant. And then some people will worry. You hear this a lot, maybe sometimes, from people who work on the history of philosophy when they had a little bit to drink, where they'll say, look, oh, in the past, you know, it was grand, and everyone wrote these beautiful theories, and people listened to us, and it made a difference. Whereas now we're just kind of like the accountants of thought. We all sit around, we work on a little problem, we noodle it away on things. It's dull, it's institutionalized, we have targets we've got to hit. And they'll worry about the problem of specialization, the fact we're institutionalized, and all those things. And they'll glorify or romanticize what it was like in the past, where imagine just being Aristotle and be like, I'm just going to have a theory of everything. Like, he literally has a theory of everything. He's like, I've got a reason for that. And some of it's completely insane. So he notices at one point that, I'm just telling this is one of my favorite stories, he notices at one point that some fish have the protruding, you know, their jaw comes out a bit this way. And he's wondering about why this is. And he offers his reason, and his reason is, well, it's because they feed upside down. Right? It's completely false. They don't. He could have just checked. But he's, you know, he gets to have a theory of everything, and that could be fun and liberating. Okay, so that's one thought. The other thought was that maybe the history of philosophy is subjective, right? And usually the way this will go is like, look, you can't, you know, you philosophers can't agree on anything. We know that. But you Kantians can't even agree on stuff. So you both read the same text, and I say, look, it's saying this. And someone else says, no, it's saying that. And then we argue about it. And you're like, what's the point of that? So I obviously find that frustrating, but I also think it's really worthwhile. And maybe this just taps into something that's wrong with me, but my favorite bits in the history of philosophy are the bits that are weird, right? Are the bits that are fractured. So there are bits in Kant that make sense, always got a nice argument. I don't really care about those. His arguments aren't particularly good. He's not a good arguer, terrible arguer. What I like about him is the bits where he's hit on something. So he's hit upon something about the nature of freedom, for instance, but it's messy as hell, and people argue, he's saying this. And you really can't be saying that because of this. And one reading would just be like, Kant's a mess. But the other thing would be, no. The actual like terrain itself, the concept of freedom is really difficult and it's multifaceted and it pulls you in different directions. And he's got onto that better than anyone else has. So there's this nice line by this famous German historian of philosophy who says something like, the weirdest or darkest parts of Kant are the most fertile ground for future work. So in a way I would say, yeah, it is subjective, it is messy and it's difficult, but that's what makes it so worthwhile. You know, there are some philosophers, oh, that's their argument, that's why it doesn't work. Cool, we're done, goodbye. Whereas, you know, some of the really dark, deep, weird stuff's cool. But again, maybe that just tells you something about me. Oh, can I say one
more thing? Yeah, please, say one more thing.
I forgot that you said something really interesting, which was, do you think, so you asked, I answered it about school children, but you were asking more broadly, and that was, should we keep philosophy and the history of philosophy separate? And I should, again, lay my cards on the table. So I'm going to say, when we do history of philosophy, we're doing philosophy, right? You've heard my line. But some historians of philosophy would disagree with me, and they would say, I'm a bad historian of philosophy. I mean, they actually say this, right? I'm bad at history of philosophy, because they say, no, history of philosophy should just be incredibly scholarly, and it should just be looking at what these people actually said, and that's all you should do. And if you evaluate what they say, or try and use it for current purposes, you're kind of botching it, or you're kind of changing their views, and you're kind of doing a bad, they'll say, you're doing bad history, and you're doing bad philosophy, right? So some people will complain with my approach, but screw them, keep doing it.
Joe, thank you very much for that. That was really great. Please thank Joe again. So we've got a little bit of time left, and I have a proposal for the little bit of time that we've got left, which is this. I mentioned earlier that we've given a slightly larger proportion of the airtime to you guys than we have to the speakers, and there are a few thoughts for why that might be appropriate. One is sort of cropped up already, which is that at least some people's conception of philosophy, the concept of philosophy of them involves philosophizing, doing philosophy is a necessary feature of what it is to do philosophy. So that if we were here sitting back, sipping wine, really quietly, passively listening, we would really legitimately be able to call this a philosophy event. It would be something else instead. So that might be one thought, which is why there's always some dimension of dialogue whenever there's a philosophy talk or something. But the other thought is this, if our work is about bringing people together to have conversations like this, and as I've mentioned, bringing people together who are not necessarily having from a background of philosophy or coming together to talk at all. And one of the things we're interested in asking people to consider is whether when we evaluate what philosophy is and what the point of it is, Whether we should be thinking about something slightly broader than the work that gets done by experts in universities, whether we should be thinking about, and Erin gestured to some of these things, the conversations that we have on social media and the chats we have on the bus, so those really informal, spontaneous, philosophical conversations or moments, but also events like this where people come together, there are experts here, there may be inexperts here as well. It's been documented today, but often these conversations are undocumented, sometimes forgotten before we leave the room. Has philosophy happened here? If it has, is it of any value? Is it in any way comparable to the kind of more studious expert work that is done by professional philosophers? And so the final thing I want you to talk about on your tables is just to turn the gaze inwards and think, what's the point in tonight? or events like this? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, and we'll hear a couple of those, and maybe if you guys have any thoughts on what the point of tonight is, or nights like this, and after that we'll draw things to a formal close. Okay? Thanks. Right, yeah, so any thoughts on the point of events like this? Jade?
So something that came up in our group was the question of curiosity and keeping a questioning open mind and challenging assumptions that you might have about the life that you live and the things around you. So something that I mentioned was that I'd read that philosophers are some of the only people who keep a childlike curiosity about the world within them for their entire lives and keep thinking about the world in the way that a child would, and just questioning, you know, why this, why that, why the other. And something you were saying was about challenging assumptions, and events like this help you to keep that sort of critical mind and that sort of awareness to think about things like the foodie, things you might not think about, challenging our assumptions of what is a foodie, is that important? And I think it led into what you were saying, Mandy, about what is the point of philosophy? Is it just about thinking, or is it about that informing your life? Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I kind of see these kind of events as doing two things. I mean, first of all, clearly it's important to think about some of these issues that are of concern, but for me that's only the first step. That actually if I think of what certainly some of the ancient philosophers were doing, yes, they were engaging with dialogue and thinking together, but it was always a spur to action in terms of how we live the good life, how we live with each other, how we live virtuous lives. So I think for me it's these kind of events provide that kind of space to think, but then actually to go and do something with what we've thought about.
So it sets the bar quite high. If some kind of contribution to well-being or living a good life is one of the kind of ultimate justifications or ends of this kind of work, then you might think, well, we've spent 2.5 hours, we've listened to only 30 minutes of people speak, we've not been here very long. For those of us who do philosophy quite regularly, maybe this is one piece in a bigger picture of regular philosophizing. For people who maybe come along and rarely or never do this, you might think, well, can we make those claims about the contribution of events like this to well-being for those people, or are we at risk of overstating the value of events like this? I don't know whether somebody else wants to talk about that.
Thank you, Rach. I said something like really good when you let us have our conversation. Now I can't remember hardly any of it. But basically the generic gist was something along the lines of before, like, public philosophy, rather doing philosophy, as in having a discussion, is a process of self-development. It's not necessarily to convince the other person of your viewpoint. It's rather to order your ideas in a way that you can, one, communicate clearly to that other person with regards to what you know about that other person and how they're going to understand it, but also learning lessons about yourself in that communication and coming to various new lessons about yourself that perhaps you didn't know about before you started doing that process. And public philosophy, like, completely facilitates that in that regard.
Thank you. That sounded like it came out in a very articulate
way. It was so
way,
much better
actually.
Before, though.
Well, you wanted to also speak on that? We'll hear from you, and then we'll hear from somebody over here, please, and then we'll have to end.
I think the thing that I was kind of, that I feel quite deeply actually about philosophy or not philosophy, or, you know, is it good for your health? can it contribute to your health? Is the sort of, this person here began to boil it down to much more kind of fundamental things that are going on. What chimes with me is then that if you take that further, is that philosophy is simply about thinking and the awareness of the fact that you can think, awareness that you have a mind, which is slightly different from a brain, it's consciousness. And therefore you have the possibility to reading, if you haven't come across it or are not that way minded, of reading about philosophies which separate the process of thought from the biological being. So allow you to choose how you think, whether you act, whether you don't, whether sometimes it's good to act and sometimes it's good not to act. And I think all that awareness, really, if you can think about it, it's you can say, well, that contributes to your mental health. Your awareness of your own mind, surely, is something that you need to be able to get to grips with your own mental health and realize when you're in good shape and what you can do to keep that, or when you're going somewhere, you know, down a dark alley, and how to kind of steer yourself from that.
Thank you. Interesting perspective on the sort of therapeutic potential dimension of this kind of.
Yeah, it's about awareness and choice, really. At the end of the day.
And we have got almost no time left. But should we just squeeze one more in? If there is anything, is there someone that you would like to put forward from your group?
We had the same notions really that this group had about what the point of being here tonight. You know, we talked about opening ourselves up, about being in community, about pursuing new lines of knowledge. But I think the most important thing was something that Stuart touched on right at the end, where he said there's a real lack of dialogue and critical inquiry in our community. And it's caused us to come together and people from outside the academic institution to come in to find where that might be taking place. So the point of public philosophy, I think, is imagine the lack of that. Well, if our dialogical interaction with each other was no more, then that would be too horrible to contemplate. So even if this space exists to have, whether we're doing philosophy or philosophizing, then I think that is important.
Thanks for that. So I want to just say some thank yous, and then we can all go on our way. I really want to thank the Forum for European Philosophy for giving us some of the money to put on this evening, and also for the School of Philosophy, Religion and History of Science, who also contributed in quite a lot of ways. Our speakers, Joe, Mary and Aaron, for giving their time freely and their ideas and provocations. My Thinking Space colleagues, Nazia, Amanda, Claire, who've come tonight from Trinity to support us. Our philosophy students, so Aaron, Josh, Jade, Claire, Frida, who've come to help us. Paul, for doing the sound. And please, Simon, finally, for taking photographs. But I particularly want to thank Liz. So Liz started working on this about 1,000 years ago, and her days for allocated to this ran out a long time ago, and she's dealt with all of the inexplicably complicated and unbelievably boring problems that arise in putting together an event with grace and intelligence. So thank you. So if you've had a pleasant evening tonight, it's largely thanks to Liz. But thank you to all of you for coming, and enjoy the rest of your evening. And bye.